Welcome to the Education Gadfly Show. Hello, this is your host, Mike Petrilli of the Thomas B. Fordham Foundation, here with my co-host, the man who puts the happy in the happy hour, Rick Hess.
Hey, Mike, man, I'm sitting here, and I am stunned once again by your mastery of mouth sounds.
Yeah,
I bet you were just everybody's favorite kid in ninth grade.
You know, I have to say, I'm pretty good at the air trombone. I've even played a few weddings.
That's pretty cool.
All right, well, you know what I heard this week, Rick, that I found interesting? I found out that people are listening to the Education Gadfly Show in secret, right? I mean, well-respected policy professionals are tuning in to listen to the show, but for some reason consider it an illicit activity. I mean, what do you make of that?
It's the gulag education, baby. No, I got to say that those of our colleagues who are listening to the Gadfly podcast in secret probably have a really good sense of how to safeguard the professional reputation.
Very nice.
So I think we can only salute their judgment.
That's probably true. That makes us feel like we have smart people listening to our podcast.
I think that's true.
Okay, well, let's get going, Rick. We're going to start with the game of Pardon the Gadfly, where we debate three of the hot issues of the week. Then we'll have an interview with Kate Walsh about why so many elementary school teachers can't teach reading. And finally, our especially weird correspondent, Jennifer, will serve up a dose of education news of the weird. All right?
I'm fired up, baby.
So let's play Pardon the Gadfly. Here's our first topic, Rick. Republican South Carolina Governor Mark Sanford made some interesting comments lately. He's a big fan of school choice and generally known as a libertarian, and yet he wants to shift responsibility for education funding to the state and equalize funding across districts. You don't hear this from a Republican very often. Why? Because he thinks it's the best way to make funds portable and facilitate school choice. So, Rick, what are your thoughts on what the experts called weighted student funding?
Well, I think Sanford's an interesting guy, and he's on to something. Part of the way districts and spending and schools are tied together is what makes it so hard for us to really reinvent the way we're delivering education. We've got schools which come with set chunks of money out of the district budget. Principal never controls it. Principal doesn't get to decide how to allocate the money. Teacher positions are funded off formulas, which creates a lot of problems. Well, if you start to move this stuff out of the district structure to the state and say, look, we're just going to fund based on which kids you enroll, it starts to get a whole lot easier to do, you know, different, to solve problems in different ways.
What do you mean by different kids that you're going to enroll?
All right. So now this is the key problem, right? So one way to do this funding is to just say everybody, for every kid you get, you're going to get $6,500. Problem is that we know some kids are cheaper to educate than other kids. And that creates a real incentive to try to just attract the cheap kids. Mm-hmm. Now, in order to deal with that, what you do is you say some kids are going to bring more money than others. So you say kids who are learning English as a second language bring an extra chunk of money. If you were creative, you might say, you know, it's $1 a pound for kids because you got to do remedial phys ed because the chunky kids don't pay attention.
Wait, you're saying pay more for the fat kids.
Yeah, but there's all kinds of perverse incentives there, too, because then you start to fatten them up at lunchtime
right, or something. Right,
but you get the idea. And the bottom line here, of course, is that all of these weights are pretty much just made up. You can get experts to give suggestions, but we see how that works in adequacy suits. Now, Mike, I mean, you've got some thoughts on this. Fordham's done some work here with charters.
Well, right. I mean, this is especially important for charter schools. I mean, what we do know is that states that have moved funding to the state level, where the state picks up a bigger part of the tab, end up doing a better job funding charter schools. Why is that? Well, because most states, when they pass charter school laws, they say, look, we'll pay the full state share of the charter school funding, but they don't have the guts to make the local districts cough up their money and give it to charter schools. You know, so as a result, you get states like Minnesota that have moved more to statewide funding that do a better job funding charters.
So what happens with the chunky kid?
What happens with the chunky kid? Look, I mean, I think this is a real problem, Rick. I don't think we want to give incentives for people to, you know, keep forcing candy down their throats.
That would be fun, huh? The candy covered charter, baby.
Very nice. I like that. Is there a fat kid charter school?
That would be nice. Combine it with a kind of a fat camp.
Very good.
Be lean and mean. All right. Mike, topic two. You're going to love this one because I know how you are about, you know, new federal test data.
Rippa!
The new National Assessment of Educational Progress scores are out in science. Ooh, Mike?
I am like a kid in a candy store.
Well, you could go to the fat kid school.
I could.
Mike, what do the NAEP science scores show?
Well, let me tell you, Rick.
Oh.
Well, look, first of all, What's very interesting about these scores is that only a handful of states made real progress at the fourth grade and eighth grade. And guess what? Most of those states are the states that hold schools accountable for science achievement.
Which states are you talking about?
This is Kentucky, Virginia, South Carolina, right? There might be one or two others in the country that hold schools accountable for science, but that's it. And they're all making big gains. I think this is actually good news for the accountability movement, because once again, it shows that if you hold schools accountable for a subject, schools will respond and get results.
Now, some critics might say, well, sure, they're making progress, but that's because they're shifting attention from something like history or foreign language and devoting that time to science.
Well, first of all, it's better than shifting attention from everything else just to math and reading. Okay, now at least science is on the table. And I think in most of these states, social studies or history is on the table as well. And this is going to feed this debate that's going on right now in Washington about whether or not, under No Child Left Behind, schools should also be held accountable for science, maybe even history, not just math and reading. Now, the other big news is that we've got some gains at the fourth grade level, flat at the eighth grade, and then we trail off at the 12th grade. Rick, what's going on with that?
Well, I mean, I think one of the things that we all know is that you don't need a whole lot of specialized expertise to be a decent science teacher at fourth grade, and it's less critical at the eighth grade. By the time we're at the high school level, though, it actually helps if you know chemistry and biology and physics. Now, we also happen to know that kids who do well in chemistry and biology and physics in college have a lot of attractive job offers that pay pretty darn well, which offer, you know, relatively stable careers. Paying folks who are going to teach physics the same as we're going to teach somebody who teaches phys ed, or paying chemistry majors the same as we pay, you know, literature majors coming out of college, is going to create real and obvious problems in terms of attracting talent who are going to be able to teach science in the schools.
Right. What did you major in, Rick?
Political science.
Yep.
Which isn't a real science, and hence, I didn't have a whole lot of attractive offers when I came out.
Very nice.
Good. That's why grad school looms so large in my future.
That's right. Education wonkery, you know? If you can't do anything else, you can always be an education policy wonk.
It is. The last refuge of the incompetent.
That's right. Okay, our final topic, bilingual education. Now, you know, Rick, this is an especially wonky show today, don't you think? I mean, weighted student funding and NAEP and now bilingual ed. I mean, what's happening?
I hope our guerrilla listenership's not going to flee for, you know, establishment media, baby.
Okay, well, a new analysis by the Boston Globe shows that 3 years after Massachusetts switched to entirely to English immersion only, that limited English proficient students aren't doing very well, especially in big urban districts. So what do you think, Rick? Is it time to bring back bilingual ed?
Well, you know, one, this is kind of interesting in light of the ongoing conversation, obviously, about immigration reform. But that's another subject we might not want to get into. I mean, frankly, to me, it's always seemed that the evidence on English only or a bilingual acquisition is kind of mixed, right? What the evidence seems to show is that there's no perfect strategy, and that for different kids in different settings, different stuff can make sense. Me, I've got no problem with using some limited degree of bilingual acquisition. Get the kids acclimated. If you've got a kid who doesn't speak any English, throwing them whole hog into a fourth grade or sixth grade class where they're not going to understand anything going on doesn't seem real promising. But this seems to me a bridging strategy. It's a temporary approach. And what you do is you get the kids into an immersion, into a bilingual situation where you can get them prepared and give them a year, maybe give them a year and a half, but get them on out. This doesn't seem to be what the bilingual lobby has in mind, though.
Rick, I'm so disappointed with you. Now, hold on. You're saying you're going to take a fourth grader, 10-year-old, okay? And you're saying that 10-year-old who arrives in the country from Mexico or Guatemala or wherever, you don't think that 10-year-old can learn English quickly? I mean, have you met 10-year-olds? They're still like a sponge, okay? And yet, you're going to just side up with your bilingual ed advocates. You spent too much time in your ed school, Rick, obviously. Okay, these bilingual education people, they have a vested interest in making sure that it takes a long time for these kids to learn English, right? And they will tell you, you know, it takes 7 years for the average child to learn English. 7 years. It's
Mike,
crazy.
I thought you were a flexibility guy. So if you're a principal at a school and you want to throw little Juan into this fourth grade classroom, you say, I don't care if you understand a single word being said, a single sign on the wall, just swim with it?
Look, here's what I believe, okay? Until we had some of these reforms in bilingual education, kids were languishing in bilingual ed forever, right? And their parents didn't even know this was happening. A lot of their parents assumed that their kids were learning English at school. Of course, what else would happen? So at the very least, you've got to create a system where parents have to opt their kids into some kind of bilingual education instead of the other way around.
That's reasonable. And it's got to be a temporary thing. It can't be a 7-year, much less a 4-year operation. It's got to be a 1-year, 1.5
Rick,
year.
Rick, the gong has spoken.
Dude, I love that gong.
You love that. I love it too, because that means that is all we have for Pardon the Gadfly.
Ooh.
Now.
What's next, Mike?
Now, well, very tasty. We turn to an interview this week with our good friend, Kate Walsh. Now, you know Kate, right?
I do know. And, you know, funny that you should say tasty. I mean, in the world of education wonkery, I got to say, Kate is one of those people who adds a touch of glamour and style. Kate's one of those people who puts the car in carburetor, baby. She puts the ball in Baltimore. Kate is the kind of gal who puts the fender in fender bender.
Well, very good. Wow. Well, I hope that Kate views all of this as a compliment. So, well,
I think I've said it to her many an occasion after a glass, so I can't see why not.
All right. Well, earlier this week, Kate's group released a blockbuster report about education schools. Let's find out what it said. Kate, welcome to the show.
Thank you.
Now, first of all, I really have to thank you for coming on because, you know, a couple weeks ago we had Dave Saba on from the American Board for Certification of Teacher Excellence. And I have to say he was very diplomatic, but, you know, didn't really want to give any firm answers. And Rick later called his interview pablum, I think was the term.
But in the nice way.
In a nice way. And then last week we interviewed Tom Lovelace, and thanks to some technical problems, basically, he was virtually inaudible. So you either have a lot of guts to join us, or you clearly have not been listening to the podcast.
Well, I won't admit to the latter accusation, but no one's ever accused me of being diplomatic.
Okay. Well, good. That's what we like. Now, Kate, this week your organization, the National Council for Teacher Quality, released a report showing that the typical education school does a horrible job teaching elementary school candidates the basics of reading instruction. Just 15% of the institutions you found teach all five elements of scientifically based reading instruction. Now, some people are going to say that this is just some sort of attempt to make ed schools look bad, that surely the situation is not as dire as you described. So tell us a little bit about the methodology you used. I mean, what did an ed school have to do in order to be considered okay in your book?
Well, we made it very easy for a school to pass, and let me explain how. We looked at both syllabi and the required text for each class. So some people might say, well, you can't judge a class unless you sit in on the course the whole semester. The syllabi don't really reflect the content of the class. Well, a syllabi is basically no different from a restaurant menu. So if you're going to a restaurant and see that there's no fried chicken on the menu, it's unlikely that you'll go back into the kitchen and find fried chicken. So, but it does beg the question, why would anyone do a syllabus unless it stands for something? They're rarely just one-page documents that make loose reference to the content of the class. They're often 10 to 15 pages long, describing in considerable detail what the lectures are going to be.
So, Kate, I mean, so this sounds like a pretty generous method then. I mean, they just have to have scientifically reading instruction on the menu.
They just had to have it on the menu and in the text.
Okay. And they didn't even do that.
Probably our best analysis that we did was judging the content of the textbook.
Okay. All right. Now, Kate, I mean, what's going on here? I mean, how can the ed schools possibly justify not teaching elementary school teachers how to teach reading scientifically? I mean, what do they say to defend themselves?
Well, it's interesting. I haven't seen a whole lot of defense, and I haven't heard from one school since we released the study on Monday saying that we got it wrong, so that tells us something. I see a little bit of listserv chatter here and there, and again, I'm not seeing anybody refute our assertion that they're not teaching the science of reading. I think it basically boils down to the fact that ed schools are the last bastion of the reading wars. And many of them proudly would stand up and say, no, they don't teach the science of reading. They don't believe in it.
Right, right. Because it's almost a quasi-religious belief in whole language. Right. All right, so Kate, how do we fix this problem? I mean, is it possible to get the ed schools to get their act together? Or do we just have to give up on them and go around them with alternative certification and those sorts of things?
Well, that's a solution. I don't know where the answer lies in that solution, because I don't know why an alt-cert teacher would know how to teach reading just because they're good in math or science. I mean, reading is something you have to acquire specifically in a course or in your own independent reading. So That's not a solution. Certainly the solution absolutely requires that states start to hold ed schools accountable for what their graduates know and learn.
Okay. Well, very good. Well, Kate, congrats on a fantastic study and for all the attention it's getting. And thanks for coming on the show.
Thank you.
So, Rick, now, you know, you did a study a little while ago showing that education schools do a bad job teaching principals the basics of management. Now we know from Kate's group that they also do a bad job teaching elementary schools the basics of reading instruction. I mean, what the heck do they do a good job with?
Well, as somebody who spent a fair bit of time in a lot of ed schools, I got to say, at a minimum, at an absolute minimum, I've seen a number of lovely floral arrangements outside the dean's offices. Mm-hmm. So I think, at a minimum, you got to give them credit for that.
Yeah, very nice, very nice. I mean, and of course, you also are still not so far ago, we're at the AERA conference, right, where you got to taste kind of a buffet of the ideas coming out of the ed schools. Right?
That's true. And not only that, but they also serve a decent open bar at many of these places. So I think, you know, I think credit is due.
Right, right, right. All right, so, I mean, again, they can't seem to get the basics down. They can't seem to train people very well, but they have good floral arrangements.
It's a profession, it's like any other.
Very good. All right, well, it is finally time for everybody's favorite education news of the weird with our very special, very weird correspondent, Jennifer Leischer. Jen, what is weird this week?
Well, if you purchase a burger and fries at the Basha High School cafeteria in Chandler, Arizona, you receive 3 complimentary half-ounce ketchup packets.
Ooh.
Those in love with the tomatoey condiment, however, have to pay more. The school has recently begun charging 25 cents extra for every pair of ketchup packets exceeding the standard 3 allotment. And students are seeing red. Some wore shirts labeled Free Heinz. Others started bringing ketchup from home, which is a violation of health code, and school officials have threatened to suspend seditious bottle toters. Defending her policy, Principal Christine Marciando said, "If you have unrestricted access to things that explode, things will happen." We assume she's referring to the ketchup and not WMDs. Rick, what's your favorite condiment, and does it explode?
I'm partial to that relish they've got at the ballpark that you load up on your hot dog. And I can testify that it does explode because there was this 4-year-old who threw it off the upper deck last season, and that thing just was all over the woman in the beige dress underneath. It exploded like nobody's business.
Okay, well, I have a better question. When did we upgrade to ketchup packets? What happened to the vat of ketchup with the ladle where they slap it down on the tray and there you go? It would solve the whole problem.
Petrilli used to air trombone right into it. It was a nightmare back in the day.
But I mean, I can't believe there are kids getting suspended for bringing ketchup bottles to school. I mean, what do you go home and you tell your parent, "Well, I got busted." They say, "What? Would you get busted drinking at school?" No, I was sucking on the ketchup bottle.
That's a low-quality suspension.
But,
these Free Heinz t-shirts, imagine if our kids had that kind of energy and enthusiasm about something that mattered.
I know. Imagine if. Well, let's keep imagining it, but for now, that is all the time we have.
All we got, baby.
Want to remind our listeners to read the original Education Gadfly, which is at edexcellence.net. Till next week.
I'm Rick Hess.
And I'm Mike Petrilli of the Thomas B. Fordham Foundation, signing off.